You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Hello, and welcome to this podcast, Identification of Key Diagnostic Criteria and Optimal Management Options for Eosinophilic Esophagitis, which is hosted by Med Learning Group. My name is Dr. Nirmala Gonsalves. I'm a professor of medicine at Northwestern University, the Feinberg School of Medicine in Chicago, Illinois. With me today is Dr. Kim Fotenhauer, a board-certified osteopathic family physician and a fellowship-trained diabetologist. She is currently the director of clerkship curriculum and an assistant professor at Michigan State University College of Osteopathic Medicine. In this episode, we'll be talking about the importance of identifying the key symptoms and clinical presentation of eosinophilic esophagitis, or EoE, from a family medicine perspective. Welcome, Dr. Fotenhauer.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here today.
My first question is, as a family medicine practitioner, what are the symptoms that raise your suspicion of an EoE diagnosis in both children and adults?
So, great question. In children, we start to think about this when we first see things like feeding problems, like food refusal, vomiting, or even failure to thrive. You sometimes hear about things like coughing after eating or abdominal pain, but those are more common in older children too. Older children can talk about things like heartburn or dysphagia or food impaction. And then in anyone, we can see abdominal pain, nausea, vomiting, or even regurgitation. In adolescents or adults, they typically present the third to fourth decade of life and more commonly in males. And adults can have things like dysphagia, food impaction, or there can be that sensation of food getting stuck. We also hear about things like heartburn or chest discomfort, but these are usually minor symptoms. But this is where it can get a little bit confusing because often when we hear these things, the first thing we think of is GERD. Teenagers and adults kind of tend to underestimate these symptoms. Many have made some adjustments over time, such as eating slowly, chewing carefully, or cutting food into smaller pieces, using sauces to lubricate food, or drinking liquids to dilute foods. And they may also tend to avoid certain foods that can cause that dysphagia, things like bread, meat, or large pills.
So thank you. At what point in your practice do you then refer to a gastroenterologist?
So often the first thing we try is treatment for GERD if they have some of those similar symptoms. But if that's not working or we get some of the more severe symptoms, things like food getting stuck or failure to thrive, that's when we start to refer to a gastroenterologist. So then Dr. Gonzalez, as we punt this back to our gastroenterologist, you being the expert, can you walk us through what some of the key criteria you use to associate this diagnosis?
Thanks, Dr. Fotenhauer. I think that is a really good question. Once you refer over to a gastroenterologist, we then will perform an endoscopy because that is how we make the diagnosis, not just based on clinical symptoms. And it's important to recognize the type of features that we see on endoscopy. So there's a myriad of endoscopic features that we recognize. So, and they are all based on what we call the endoscopic reference score. We have a tool that actually grades these features that we see. Common features include edema or swelling of that esophageal mucosa, and that's a loss of the vascular pattern that we see on endoscopy. We see endoscopic rings, concentric rings, that make the esophagus almost look like a slinky or a trachea in some cases. White plaques or exudates are the white speckles that are in along the length of the esophagus, and they actually correspond to eosinophilic microabscesses under the biopsies. Linear furrows or the creases can be seen in the esophagus, as well as stricturing or scar tissue. So when we see these features, that clues us into this diagnosis, and it leads us to take the biopsies. And before I get into those biopsies, I mentioned the endoscopic reference score. It's called EREFS. It's now part of almost every endoscopic reporting system. So when you, as a family practitioner, get these endoscopic reports, you might see this reference. And there's grades to these endoscopic findings. So edema is graded from 0 to 1, rings are graded from 0 to 3, exudates 0 to 2, furrows 0 to 1. So that can help you assess how severe the endoscopic features are. So typically, every time we do an endoscopy, we will use that endoscopic reference score. Back to the biopsies, you know, this is how we critically make the diagnosis, is taking biopsies. It's very important to recognize that EoE is a very patchy disease. So we need to take multiple biopsies along the length of that esophagus, both in the proximal and distal esophagus. And we need anywhere from 5 to 6 biopsies in order to increase that diagnostic yield, knowing it's a patchy disease. When we send the biopsies, it then goes to the pathologist. The pathologist will look at that tissue and make this diagnosis. And they have certain histologic features that they look for. So not only just those eosinophils that are in the top part of the biopsy specimen or superficial layering, we count the number of eosinophils. We need to have at least 15 or more in that specimen. They also use a histologic scoring system, looking at the grade and stage of inflammation. So things like degranulation of eosinophils, epithelial hyperplasia, basal zone hyperplasia, intercellular edema, spongiosis, just to name a few. The other thing as gastroenterologists that we do is we try to put everything in the right clinical context, because not all swallowing dysfunction is EoE, and sometimes not all eosinophils in the esophagus are EoE. So we need to really think through our differential diagnosis, which includes reflux, sometimes hypereosinophilic syndrome, inflammatory bowel disease, achalasia, some other connective tissue diseases, just to name a few. So we really need to think about that as the right clinical context. So Dr. Fotenhauer, what are the initial treatment approaches you find most effective in your practice for recently diagnosed EoE?
So great question. You know, we really look at resolving these symptoms as well as treating the underlying pathology. So there's a couple of ways of doing this. We can do it with diet or we can do it with medication. So most commonly, there's several kinds of diets that can be effective. The most severe being one called the elemental diet. So, or the most difficult, I would say, the one being called the elemental diet. And so that is a nutrition that's a liquid form, really reserved for those that are most severe. And we would do this in conjunction with our GI colleagues, of course. If you could also go through an elimination diet, so eliminating some of the most common allergens out of the diet. This, again, we do with nutritionists or GI, because eliminating large food groups is really challenging for many patients. And then you can also do allergy testing to see which allergens are most prevalent, or which we can also do allergy testing to see which of those they're most allergic to, and then just eliminate responsive to that. Really, the medication-wise, we often do proton pump inhibitors and start with that. And that used to be one of the things that we tried to avoid, because we tried to rule out GERD with using proton pump inhibitors. But now it's not a diagnostic requirement for EoE. And so we can use that and often get a good response. About 20 to 30% of patients can see a response from this treatment. You can also do swallow topical corticosteroids. This can be done over a course of 8 to 12 weeks. We do see side effects with this though, right? The things you would think about, so esophageal candidiasis or oral thrush most commonly. And then now we have some biologics, and this is also done in conjunction with our GI colleagues, but we do have something called dupilumab, which we can use in those that are over the age of 12. What do you find in your practice that you put patients on most commonly before you send them back to us in family medicine?
Yes, that's a great question. And I think it really comes down to talking about the pros and cons of each of these options with the patients and helping make the right decision in a very shared decision-making fashion. I think for our own practice, you know, we talk about medical therapy versus dietary therapy. Medical therapy, as you pointed out, being proton pump inhibitors, they're now a treatment and not a diagnostic tool. Dietary therapy being primarily the empiric elimination diet, so taking out those common foods that trigger EoE. And additional medications being swallow topical corticosteroids in patients who don't want to do dietary therapy. And of course, the new medication, the injectable medication, dupilumab, which targets that Th2 immune pathway. So a lot of times it comes down to a discussion with each individual patient on what's important for them in terms of their goals of care. So how do you talk to your patients? You know, we'll present these options to them. We'll help them make a decision on their treatment based on their goals of care. And then oftentimes, I'm sure they go back to you. How do you further counsel them about the pros and cons of these options?
Yeah, you know, it's great to hear from our specialists, but then we see them more on a day-to-day basis, or a more regular basis, I should say. Probably don't see them every day. But when we do, it's really about, like you said, that shared decision-making, what fits best into their lifestyle. So if this isn't a very young child, you know, an empiric elimination diet may not be very feasible, especially with the rest of the family. And so they may choose a more medication route. Or if they start with a medication route and they're not finding if they start with a medication route and they're finding a lot of side effects from that medication, then they may want to try the more elimination diet and see if they can do it in that fashion. So it's really that common, you know, talking to your patients and figuring out what works best and fits best into their lifestyle. For many people, I find that it's a combination of both. And so they do some medications, but then if they can figure out what's triggering for them, they can avoid those certain foods as well.
Right. I think it really definitely comes down to that patient input and the patient goals of care. And we tend to have a pretty extensive conversation. So when you send them to see a specialist, we tend to outline a lot of these options for them. And many of them do have very predefined goals that are important to them. Some people would like to just take a medication without trying to avoid any foods. Some people would really like to understand their food triggers. And some patients really have very profound atopic disease, concomitant atopic disease, and would benefit from a biologic therapy like dupilumab. So we definitely review all of those with them. And it's nice to hear that you further hash that out with them when you see them. And so as a gastroenterologist, when I talk to patients about different treatments, I really have treatment goals in the back of my mind. Because in clinical practice, treatment goals are not only focused on that histologic efficacy. So certainly we want to get rid of the eosinophils, of course. This is eosinophilic esophagitis, and we want to improve that. But I also think about different endpoints, the first being symptoms. We really want resolution of dysphagia without the need to avoid food based on texture for our patients. We definitely want improvement in histopathology, so ideally improving eosinophils on under 15 and getting them as low as we can. And as gastroenterologists, we also want improvement in endoscopic features. We want improvement in those inflammatory features and strictures, and ideally getting that stricture diameter over 15. So those are the things I have in the back of my mind in terms of treatment goals for that patient. Then when I sit down in the clinic and go over those treatment options, we really hash out a little bit about the pros and cons of different therapies. So we start off with talking about medication, then we start off talking about diet. When we think about proton pump inhibitors, that's one of the first medications that we will discuss. That medication now is a therapy, not just a diagnostic tool anymore. And it's effective based on recent AGA guidelines in about 42% of patients. So it's a reasonable first therapy to start in patients who may want to do medical therapy. The other medication that we talk to them about is swallow topical corticosteroids, which are basically asthma-like medications that they'll swallow into their esophagus. And that, based on the AGA guidelines, is about 65% effective. So while these medications are effective, they can have some Side effects are rare, but they can have some side effects that we need to think about, and those being oral thrush or esophageal candidiasis in about 5 to 15% of patients, and in rare cases, adrenal suppression. These things are uncommon, but they're certainly things that we need to be mindful of as we treat patients with this. When I talk to them about dietary therapy, we typically will be using empiric elimination diet that's really been favored over elemental diet or allergy testing direct diet. And the empiric elimination diet eliminates specific food triggers that are triggers for EoE. But dietary therapy is not the right choice for every patient. It is the right choice in patients who really want to get to the bottom of their food triggers in order to avoid those food triggers. And the other thing we discuss with them is the new FDA-approved medication, dupilumab, which is a biologic therapy, a monoclonal antibody, which targets two allergic hormones, both IL-4 and IL-13, and is very effective at reducing inflammation in the esophagus, improving symptoms, as well as improving endoscopic features. And many of our patients, 70 to 80% of our EoE patients are atopic, so many of them may have very severe atopic disorders and are on different treatments for their conditions. And they're, in those cases, this medication might be a perfect fit for them. So it's a conversation that we have with our patients. We ask them what their goals of care are, what they want to do for treatment. We help scaffold that decision for them and together make a decision for them moving forward. And then the most important thing to mention is that after we start treatment with anybody, we will repeat an endoscopy and biopsy to make sure that treatment is working. Just going based on symptoms is not enough because there's a big symptom histology disconnect. So it is important to do that endoscopy. As you mentioned, Dr. Frohnhauer, patients may modify their diets. They may change their behaviors to prevent these symptoms. So going based on symptoms is not enough. What do you typically do when you see them and follow up to assess if their treatment is improving?
Yeah, so that was a great overview of all of the different treatment options. And I really like that as a family physician, because when I send patients to GI, sometimes it's this, I'm sending them to GI and I don't really know what they're going to do. And so having that basis of conversation, I think, is really important with our patients of what kind of care can they expect? What kind of treatment options could they expect? What kind of other symptomatic options can they expect? And really starting that conversation so that you can continue to have that conversation. And then once they decide on a treatment with you, sending them back to us to continue that. And really, like you said, monitor those symptoms. And so seeing if they're having the resolution of those clinical symptoms. And if they're not, we have other options, right? And that's an important concept to give to our patients, is that we have other options. And so if this isn't working, we can move to something else. And that would often be done in conjunction with you and GI as well.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I think the other really wonderful role of the family practitioner or the primary care provider is being a little bit of the gatekeeper as well. Because sometimes we will place patients on different therapies and they feel great. And they may go off and about, and sometimes they may stop their medications and may not recognize those symptoms that they have and not come back to us until they have a food impaction. So, you know, it's nice to have a good partnership with the primary care provider to be able to help maintain this therapy for the patient. Thank you so much. That's all the time we have for today. I want to thank Dr. Frohnhauer for sharing her insights from the perspective of a family medicine physician regarding the early recognition of symptoms for diagnosing EoE so as to provide timely intervention. And thank you for joining us. We hope you will listen to another episode in this series. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with the ACCME Essentials. I want to give a special thank you to our supporters, Regeneron Pharmaceuticals and Sanofi, who provided an independent medical education grant for this activity.